This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, have talked about language and why and how we use it for 100 episodes. Today there'll be a celebratory parade of language-related facts that you've learned from The Allusionist and I've learned from making The Allusionist, so some old facts, some new facts. Well, the new facts aren't recently invented facts, they are established facts that are making their Allusionist debut. If you have liked any of the 100 episodes of The Allusionist, tell someone else about it. Content note, there will be swears. On with the show. "100 Things We've Learned About Language from The Allusionist," in no particular order.
1.
For me, as an English teacher in Germany, The Allusionist showed me again that there's way more to language than just I am, you are, he, she, it is.
Of course. Otherwise I would have had to pack in The Allusionist after a couple of episodes.
2.
Around 1200, the word foot, as in foot, meant a person, and a non-foot was a nobody.
3.
Girl originally could be used to refer to a child of any gender. It didn't specifically denote a female child until the late 14th century.
4.
The best thing I've learned on The Allusionist is that woman is not actually derived from man in the gendered way. Definitely my favorite fun fact. Also very hard to explain. I would love a 5-second little script that I can give to people at cocktail parties, because it's currently very hard.
I'll try. Man used to mean person, not specifically a male person. A female person was weef man, which became woman because that is easier to say than weef man. How many seconds was that?
5.
Older English term for a woman was queen, and that's kind of come back around. And no, I'm not going to drop a yas queen, because I cannot pull that off and you know it.
6.
Until 1609, queen bees were known as king bees, and it's the fault of the Greek philosopher and notorious science troll Aristotle. Because although the bees had been observed laying eggs and thus were deemed biologically female, Aristotle had deemed them to be the leaders of the hive, and therefore they must be male, because leaders must be male. Never assume that facts are stronger than prejudice. And Aristotle's bullshit, or bee shit, stuck for nearly 2,000 years.
7.
In 1609, the first full-length English language book about beekeeping was published, called The Feminine Monarchy or The History of Bees, written by priest and beekeeper Charles Butler. The book contained advice about bee care and recognising bee noises. There's even a madrigal for four voices imitating the sound of bees at swarming time. And Charles Butler renamed king bees queen bees. It caught on.
8.
Charles Butler also wrote books about music theory, logical philosophy, and spelling reform, arguing for tidying up English spelling by using a phonetic alphabet. He even printed an edition of his bee book using this spelling system.
9.
My favorite thing that The Allusionist has taught me about language is that since its very inception, it has been a complete and total shit show, and that I should actually, more often than not, be really excited when I notice that it is changing in front of my very eyes. Ears. Whatever.
Yeah, it is a shit show, but Charles Butler did try.
10.
The etymology of lady is a little perplexing. It appears to derive from the Old English hlafdich. Hlaf meant loaf, and dich either meant maid or need. So loaf maid or loaf kneader. Either way, the lady was the bread maker.
11.
Lord is from the Old English hlaford or hlafwerd. Hlaf, loaf again, werd was guardian or keeper. The lord was the bread keeper. Who knew the aristocracy was so bready?
12.
I learned that the dictionary isn't the ultimate authority, and that really the language belongs to the users.
The best thing I've learned from The Allusionist is that the dictionary is a record and not a rule book, and language is too dynamic and complex for there to be a right and a wrong. And I overuse that in arguments all the time, especially with my husband, Chad.
That's true.
13.
One of my favourite things that you have taught me about language is the tension between prescriptivism and descriptivism when it comes to writing dictionaries, such that when it came up in conversation the other day that Merriam-Webster has added a second definition of literally to not just mean literally or actually, but also to mean in effect or virtually or shock horror figuratively, I was able to suppress the rage that was bubbling within and realize that no, it's okay. Dictionaries are supposed to describe the way that we use language rather than prescribe it, even though it was physically hurting me within, literally.
I'm still coming to terms with the rage, but yes, I've accepted that language changes and I can either be angry and resist it or not.
Pedant in recovery. Pedant in recovery.
14.
Dictionaries, can't trust them. They contain deliberately fake words or mount weasels as copyright traps.
15.
Best thing I've learned about language is eponyms.
Eponyms, which I didn't even know existed, and that just gave me such a cool appreciation for so many words that were based off names.
Everything I learned about your show was all about eponyms. It's led to many discussions and perhaps arguments with coworkers and family members about the use of eponyms.
I emailed back to ask what these arguments were about, and he said, it's mostly about the shoddy descriptions of screwdrivers when they're referred to as their eponyms. If I asked a kid to pass me the Phillips screwdriver versus pass me the plus screwdriver or pass me the cross screwdriver, I feel one describes the object better than the other. Some co-workers disagree. We've run around in circles quite a bit discussing this. Well, I don't know whether it's you or your colleagues arguing that plus or cross is a more intuitive description than Phillips, but I think it is. Especially considering you can have plus screws and minus screws, the ones where it's just a single straight groove, and that seems tidy to me. But
16.
The Phillips whose name is on the screws and screwdrivers is Henry F. Phillips of Portland, Oregon, and he didn't invent the crosshead screws. That was John P. Thompson. He patented the screw in 1932 and the matching screwdriver in 1933. It didn't catch on. So he sold the patent to Henry F. Phillips in 1935, who must have been quite the marketing whiz because the following year, the screws were used in Cadillacs. And as a result, the crosshead or Phillips head became the screw trend of the American automobile industry. And within a few years, it was the most popular screw in the world. Could have been the Thompson head screw. Who deserves the eponym? The inventor or the popularizer?
17.
Actually, the Phillips head screw wasn't even the first crosshead screw. The Frearson screw predated it. That was invented sometime in the later half of the 19th century by John Frearson, British engineer and temperance campaigner. The Frearson screw heads are a less rounded cross than the Phillips and a little deeper. They're also known as Reed and Prince after the company that patented the Frearson screw. But unless you're a real screwhead head, you're probably just calling them all Phillips screws. Or crossheads.
18.
Canada, I didn't forget about your favourite screwhead, the Robertson, with the square indentation. That's named after Peter Limburger Robertson, the travelling tool salesman who invented them in 1908.
19.
I definitely use guy. I call people you guys all the time. And I had no idea that there was an eponym.
And somehow I never connected it with the story about Guy Fawkes. So it was really interesting learning the journey that word has gone on to become what it means today.
A few more quick eponyms.
20.
The saxophone is named after its inventor, Adolf Sax. He also invented the sax horn, saxotromba, and sax tuba, which didn't all catch on.
21.
Sideburns are named after Ambrose Burnside, the American Civil War general and first president of the NRA.
22.
The G-spot is named in tribute to the German gynecologist Ernst Grafenberg, who did a lot of research on the role of the urethra in orgasm. Also, in 1929, he invented an early form of IUD made from silk and silver. Lux.
23.
Speaking of names...
The favorite thing that I've learned on your show is the Icelandic naming conventions. I think that was super interesting. And then also in that series about the guy named Peregrine. That has really stuck with me.
24.
One of my favorite episodes was hearing you listeners tell the stories of why you changed your names. And indeed...
25.
It turns out I'm always interested in anyone's opinions about their own names. We've all got names. Probably therefore got some thoughts and feelings about the names.
26.
It's never an acronym.
It is sometimes an acronym. The full text of Zaltzman's first law is it's almost never an acronym, especially if it's pre-20th century. But
27.
Words like laser, scuba, taser, and the care in care package, those are all acronyms.
28.
The classic four-letter swears are not acronyms.
29.
At NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, they use a lot of TLAs,
three-letter acronyms, of which, using the English alphabet, there could be 17,576.
30.
The distinction between initialisms and acronyms can do one. Is it helpful?
31.
Shelley Jackson's skin project from episode 85 has me on the lookout for visible single-word tattoos, with or without punctuation.
I was very excited after the skin project episode went out and several of you sent me pictures of your tattoos that are part of the project. Which isn't finished yet, by the way, so you could still apply.
32.
Mince. The word derives from Latin minutus, meaning small, because you're chopping a thing up very small.
33.
Bankrupt comes from Italian bancarotta, which means broken bench.
34.
Vocables, words that aren't really words, but we can just use for sounds.
Doobity-doo.
35.
I listened to the whole back catalogue, and when I think of the episode from which I learned the most, the obvious one that comes to my mind is Behave, the one about cognitive behavioral therapy, in which Jane Gregory, a therapist, she speaks about using tricks involving grammar and letters and music to help people get rid of unpleasant emotions that are caused by certain words. The connection between linguistics and psychology fascinates me.
36.
Also in that episode, I learnt tennis used to be played with the palm of the hand instead of a racket. However,
37.
Racket also used to mean palm of the hand.
38.
Séance is from a French word meaning a session, and that's from the old French savoir, to sit. Be sure to be sitting comfortably when contacting the spirits.
39.
The whole thing about mouse going to mice, which I'm convinced I understand, but despite having listened back about 9 times, I don't know how to explain it to anybody that I try to explain it to. So it made me feel really clever, but also really stupid.
40.
Also in that episode, featuring David J. Peterson, who constructs languages for films and TV shows, including Game of Thrones, I learnt that constructing languages is something I will never be clever or diligent enough to do.
41.
I have learned that a language can have a philosophy behind it. Well, of course I'm speaking about Tokipona.
Tokipona, and I have actually tried to learn a little bit of it, which I was doing for about 2 days and then I kind of gave up. So I don't remember any of it, but the point is, I learned about it, seemed cool, I put some time into trying to learn it. Although I don't know any of it now.
42.
And from Tokipona, I learned that when I'm trying to use a minimalist language, when it's not an option to crack jokes or arrange words quickly and spit them out, I have nothing left. Apparently all I am is a cloud of quips, not an actual person.
43.
The best thing I've learned about language from The Illusionist is how Americans and British people use please differently. Ever since I heard it, I've never been able to stop thinking about it. Every time I say please to an American person, I think, maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
Now when I'm in the US, I'm paralysed into inaction when I'm trying to order things at restaurants. I tend to say thank you a lot instead.
I use please more like a British person, apparently, and never really realised it until I listened to the episode and then started noticing in social situations, etc., that I was sprinkling it in while my fellow Americans were not.
44.
I just love the etymology of the word turkey. I think that is the most fascinating piece of trivia, and I've broken it out at many occasions only to be looked at quizzically, but so be it.
45.
Step. That episode was a surprise to me. During a bout of insomnia, I looked up step, as in stepchild or stepparent, and found that it meant grief. I know that some of you use different terms in your own families, and since that episode I've been trying bonus. Bonus child. Bonus mother.
46.
Listening to The Illusionist, I learned someone can be smart without being a smartass.
47.
Smart has meant clever for some 700 years, but its etymology is from the Old English for pain. Do you see the connection? Smarts are a cutting wit. Yes, that is painful, yes.
48.
A lesbian rule was a flexible metal stick used by stonemasons.
49.
Portmanteaus.
The one about portmanteaus was probably the most influential to me. I've definitely used it in a few conversations since.
Portmanteaus, I learned that was a term that exists.
And I learned that it was Lewis Carroll who coined it. Since episode 11, about that tasty but controversial portmanteau brunch, I've been collecting portmanteaus. Mostly horrible ones. Squaggle, Donkachino, Striminals, Brogut, and other words that will hopefully never catch on, but not all are bad.
50.
Endorphin, from endogenous and morphine.
51.
Tanzania, which came about after the unification of Tanganyika and Zanzibar in 1964.
52.
Electrocution, electro from electricity and cute from execute.
53.
Imagineer, a portmanteau of imagination and engineer, to mean someone who devises imaginative new technologies or concepts, such as the attractions at a Disney park. Disney did not coin the term, but they sure did trademark it.
54.
My favourite, oh, I didn't know that was a portmanteau, Velcro, a portmanteau of velour and crochet.
55.
And a big thank you to you and Susie Dent for reminding us of poor John Dennis getting his thunder stolen in episode 92.
That was a very literal idiom.
56.
Also very literal, log in. After the log on a knotted rope that would be thrown overboard from a ship to measure its speed, calculated by the length of the rope unspooled over a particular time. And that would be logged in the logbook.
57.
My favorite thing I've learned on The Illusionist is the seasonal gain and loss of language from Antarctica.
58.
Though your look at the politics of pronouns and dead names of our transgender citizens is a close second.
59.
What I have learned is that they can be used to refer to a singular person.
60.
Namaste just means hello. And after making the episode about it, I heard from several yoga instructors asking, well, what am I supposed to do now?
61.
Replacing letters in words with Zs is known as Zazification.
62.
The verb to pith means to kill by piercing the spinal cord.
63.
Orange the fruit came before orange the colour, which used to be called yellow red.
64.
The 2,000-year-old equivalent of subtweeting was writing a curse on a piece of lead and throwing it into the sacred hot spring in the city of Bath.
65.
So my favourite and definitely most quoted fact that I've learned from the podcast is that swearing has analgesic properties, which is fucking great news. See, I feel better already.
Yeah, that was a popular one.
66.
The first known written instance of the word bullshit is by T.S. Eliot.
67.
The Illusionist episode about detonating the C-bomb taught me that we're only conditioned to believe that the unt word is the worst word in the world. Interestingly, on the ABC on Easter Sunday, the ABC Australian Broadcasting Corporation dropped the C word twice.
Wow, what was the context? Christ is risen to show the cunts who crucified him.
And even I can't say it. I'm just going to say it. Cunt.
68.
I also learnt that if you make an episode about the cunt word, it doesn't matter what else you ever make. That is the only one people remember.
69.
Pelvis is from the Latin word bucket.
70.
Penis is from the Latin word little tail.
71.
Vagina is from the Latin word for sheath or husk.
72.
The favourite thing I learned from The Illusionist is that Total Eclipse of the Heart is a dangerous, dangerous song.
73.
The most memorable and interesting Illusionist story for me was episode 58, Eclipse. This is the one about aphasia, and it's interesting to me because it was in this episode that I first heard of the possibility of finally shushing my internal monologue. I've learned that language is as much a product of our anatomy as it is a product of our societal circumstance. Since then, I've secretly wanted to spend a day being wordless because Lauren Marks just makes it sound so appealing. But just a day, though.
Yeah, you could try maybe meditation rather than having an aneurysm. Although, another thing I learned...
74.
Before I interviewed Lauren about the aneurysm that caused her to lose all but 40 or so words of her vocabulary, I expected it to be a very sad story. But Lauren expressed a profound joy about both the wordlessness and then the rediscovery of language during her recovery. And of course, her experience is not everyone's experience of a brain injury, but it is comforting to know that those experiences aren't always negative either.
75.
I have to look up the spelling of hemorrhage every single time.
76.
One thing I've learnt from The Illusionist is about the oulipo, the French society of people that do weird things like writing poems with only one vowel. And after hearing that in the episode Trammels, I tried writing one and succeeded somewhat. I used the vowel A because it seemed like the easiest one. And I wrote a poem called Alan and Amy.
77.
Around the late 1400s, denial replaced the word deniance, presumably so that all of your denial is not a river in Egypt slogan t-shirts made sense.
78.
Black holes are not black. They're some of the brightest things in the universe.
79.
I'm a flutist and I love nature, so I was pleased to learn that the archaic meaning of embouchure is the mouth of a river. Thanks.
80. Reading Agatha Christie books is good for the health. I knew it in my heart, but I was pleased to have it confirmed by experts.
81.
Halcyon goes all the way back to the ancient Greek mythological character Alcyon. Her husband Ceyx was killed when Zeus threw a thunderbolt at his ship, and in her grief, Alcyon threw herself into the sea. The gods changed the couple into kingfishers, halcyon birds. And just as any newbie might make mistakes, Alcyon built her nest on the beach, where the waves threatened to wash it away. So her dad, Aeolus, god of wind, prevented storms from happening during the last 7 days of the old year and the first 7 days of the new year, so that she could lay her eggs safely. Those days are the halcyon days. Now, you might be yelling, "Oh, that's nonsense! Kingfishers don't build nests! They nest in holes, or dig tunnels in the ground, or trees, or termite mounds. In fact, kingfishers have dug tunnels up to 8.5 metres long. That's impressive! Not your wind god dad doing you a favour. I call bullshit on this whole story."
82.
The best thing I've learnt from The Illusionist is definitely from the most recent episode, Polari. And I'm quite ashamed to admit this, but I didn't know that Barnet, as in for hair, came from the Cockney rhyming slang Barnet Fair. And to make things worse, my dad is from Barnet.
83.
Vogue came from the old French vogue, to sway, or set sail, or to row. How did that come to mean fashion? Well, you're borne along by the tide of a trend.
84.
The athletic event long jump used to be called broad jump, but was changed because broad was considered so derogatory to women.
85.
Your collaboration with Erlon Woods of Ear Hustle, where he goes through a dictionary of sorts of words that he uses in San Quentin State Prison.
Indubitably.
And
86.
Survival Part 1, where you talk about a group of Welsh peoples that immigrated to a part of Patagonia in Argentina, and you talk about their struggles using Welsh in both Wales and in Argentina.
The Welsh language spoken in South America, and the fact that language do travel, and the fact that the further you travel from your home place, the fewer, more original the language is. So I'm French, and working in Brussels. And you know what? I speak German. I know a bit of Swedish also. Like, French is a language that appears everywhere. And but so does English, and I'm always happy to be reminded of that, that there's this internet connection between all of those languages that we spoke, that we borrow stuff from one another, and it's really, really nice. And I love it.
87.
I learned that some people really predicate a lot of their identity on the Oxford comma. Perhaps consider having a personality instead.
88.
Radish shares an etymological root with radical. The root is a word that meant root.
89.
Pole is from hair.
90.
Ballot is from ball, because people used to cast votes with black or white balls. We're nearly there, only 10 more to go.
91.
700 years ago, nice meant stupid or ignorant. There's nothing stupid about being nice, people.
92.
Machines are better at spotting fake online reviews than trusting, gullible humans. Specifically, I think computers trained to look out for that, not like a toaster or electric toothbrush.
93.
Jeff Bezos originally named his company Amazon Kadabra, as in abracadabra. But he changed it because his lawyer misheard it as cadaver.
94.
I still don't use emoji, and I know that my inability to understand emoji and use emoji is leaving me ignorant about a whole swathe of communication. If you want to keep a secret from me, just put it in emoji.
95.
Victorians sent Christmas cards with bacon or dead mice on the front, as well as such festive scenes as children at their parents' funeral or people being attacked by giant wasps and poker-wielding clowns. Merry Christmas! Or
96.
Merry Winterval, which was not political correctness gone mad.
97.
Indefinite hyperbolic numerals. I had never consciously thought about those before listener Stephen Chris O'Malley got in touch. And now whenever I hear someone say zillion or squillion, I think, oh,
Ah, that's a thing.
98.
Something that sounds like an indefinite hyperbolic number but isn't one is 12T. 12T was a synonym for the old hundred, the long hundred, which was 6 score or 120. That's right, the word hundred used to mean 120. That was how much an Old Norse hundred was, but the Christian hundred was 5 score or a current hundred. And for a while in English, hundred can mean either 100 or 120. So if you've been thinking, well, words are slippery eels, but at least I can rely on numbers just to mean the one thing, right? No.
99.
When I first started listening to The Illusionist, I thought I'd be learning more English language rules that I could ride around with on my high horse, beating people with my superior knowledge. But the more I listened, the more I realized that language is so much less about fixed rules and being right. I never knew splitting infinitives was a carryover taboo due to its form in Latin, and mortifyingly, that the Americans are the ones who stayed true to the original spelling of words like realize and organize. I learned instead about people and how their ideas shape their words, and how their words can shape their thoughts, and some of the ridiculous origins of expressions and how language is constantly evolving. And it seemed that everything you say is less about language and more about people, because ultimately, I suppose, language is how we relate to each other. And I love that.
100.
Ass ropes. What a wonderful word for the human intestines. Why don't we use it still?
That's the Illusionist legacy, isn't it? Ass ropes. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is halteres, noun, entomology, not to be confused with etymology, the rudimentary hindwings of flies used to maintain balance in flight. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. Music for the show is by Martin Austwick. Listen to his songs at palebirdmusic.com. Thanks to all the listeners who recorded contributions for this episode. Alaric, Amir, Angie, Ben, Brent, Brian, Bryce, Cameron, Charles, Charlie, Cheese, Christopher, Colin, David, Edward, Francis, Gabe, Gabriella, Haley, Harry, Jackie, Other Jackie, Jeff, John, Jonas, Laura, Other Laura, Laying, Matthew, Maxim, Maya, Michael, Noah, Oscar / Gleb, Rachel, Rebecca, Rick, Sarah, and Yajna. Thanks also to people who've helped me quite a lot along the way, like Greg Jenner, Raquel De Felice, Eleanor McDowell, Rishikesh Hiwi, all the people at PRX and the fellow Radiotopians. And special thanks to listener Matt, who's been doing a very sweet and funny thing for the show since near the beginning. You know how at the start of every episode where I say, "This is The Illusionist," in which I, Helen Zaltzman, describe the premise of the show in some ridiculous different way each time? Well, Matt took it upon himself to collect all of these lines in a Tumblr, inwitches.tumblr.com, and he illustrates each of them with a GIF. Sometimes when writing the lines, I've thought, what on earth is Matt going to make of this? His website is a lot of fun, you should take a look. But on the occasion of the 100th episode, Matt is handing over inwitch duties to another listener, Ashra, who has kindly volunteered to take on this responsibility. She also volunteers at the Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue Association, so she says to prepare for a lot more cat GIFs. And yes, I do say GIF, that is the side I'm on. Thanks Ashra for stepping in, and I'm very grateful to Matt for 4 years of diligent inwitching. Illusionist-related GIFs aside, Matt has many talents, but if you're looking for a project manager, drop him an email at matt@williamson.ly. And one more thank you to you for listening to the show, because without you, I would be gobbling into the void. You've been incredibly supportive, you've supplied excellent ideas for the podcast, and in contrast to a lot of painful interactions people have online, I think we have a very wholesome time together. Thank you for letting me into your ears. Follow Illusionist Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out the current live show, which hopefully is heading to an arts venue near you. And hear all the episodes, read transcripts of them, see the full dictionary entries of the randomly selected words, and read more about all of the topics at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.